Hey, my name is Walt, and this is the Banff Podcast. Mike Lafferty apologizes. He think he might have Doombots messing with his audio. He should be here momentarily. Today, we are talking to an esteemed round table to talk about World War II and Golden Age comics, and maybe get a little insight into the current Kickstarter that Fainting Goat Games is running against the Axis. To start things off, we have industry luminary, Mr. Steve Perrin. How are you doing today, sir?
See if I can get my hand up here. Yeah, everything. I am doing pretty good today.
Thanks for coming out. We appreciate it. And next to him,
My pleasure.
buried under a mountain of snow, and using hopefully hair dryers or heat rays to get out, we have Mr. Chris McLaughlin.
Hi, how you doing?
I think we all have to agree that Chris's weapon of choice in this function is heat breath, flaming breath.
Through a luchador mask. And certainly not least, but last in the batting order, we have Mr. Jason Tondreau. How are you, sir?
Number three in the order, number one in your hearts. How's everyone today?
Speaking of such things, Jason, where did you get your big degree in?
My degree is in, well, I mean, on the wall it says English literature, but my specializations are comics and medieval and Renaissance lit.
Oh, okay. I'm part of a writing group, and somebody was talking about their child getting a degree in gaming, and I had the impression that yours was in was a degree in gaming. So
No, no. There are programs that do that, and some of my colleagues specialized in online literature and video gaming and stuff. A guy that I know wrote a great dissertation on portrayals of race in World of Warcraft. Like did a great bit about how one of the troll groups there, they made a bunch of black avatars, walked into the newbie zone, and started a slave auction. And how was that done, and how did people respond to it? So it's really interesting stuff, but no, I'm not a gaming PhD. I am a comics PhD. Yeah. So your friend's off the hook.
Well,
And if somebody wants to get a comics PhD, how do they go about that?
Oh, shoot. Well, you have to find a department and a program that is either open to it or already has a track for it. For example, University of Florida in Gainesville has a PhD program with an emphasis in comic studies, which is already right there on the books, and you could just go there, take the classes, do your project, and you're all set. Otherwise, you find a faculty member that's known for the field, and you work with them. So, for example, at Cal State Northridge is where Charles Hatfield, an old friend of mine, works. Hatfield wrote the book on Jack Kirby. It won the Eisner a couple of years ago. I think it's called Hand of Fire. So you find a department where there's a faculty member who works in comics that you can use as a mentor to kind of to shepherd your dissertation through. Or you find a college, a university that's open to flexible ideas. At UC Riverside, where I went, we didn't really have a faculty member that knew comics, but we had a huge comics collection. And so it was okay to do a dissertation on comics, even though I kind of had to teach the faculty as much as they were teaching me. There's also great programs in Canada and in France. So if you're willing to travel, you can find great places to go. It's really exciting. It's a great time for our field. It's not a new field. There's old scholars in this field that have been doing it for their whole lives. But it's also increasingly hitting a national consciousness, which is kind of it, probably driven by billion-dollar movie franchises. Certainly, it's not driven by
Right.
anybody obscure like us. So yeah.
Yeah, that can't hurt.
Yeah.
Speaking of long and academic, we were here today to talk about World War II. Excuse me, and Golden Age Comics. Yeah. Can somebody, you know, just throwing it out there in the middle of the room, can somebody tell me and tell our listeners what defines the Golden Age?
Steve?
Well,
Chris, go ahead.
Well, in the Eminem Golden Age source book, the one that RPGNet dubbed appalling.
There's bragging rights right there.
I started now technically they go back to Major Malcolm Wheeler Nicholson publishing his first comic of like all new material as opposed to the reprints of the Sunday papers that they had been doing. That's generally where most people mark the beginning of the Golden Age from. Now, since I was writing exclusively about superheroes, I had to get started in 1935 with the very first sort of, you know, beginnings of what will eventually become superheroes with Dr. Occult. Although I have to mention guys like Slam Bradley and all the old two-fisted adventurers, you know. So if you want to talk exclusively about superheroes, then I think we are. You start in 1935, at least for me. And to me, the Golden Age goes right up until the start of the Silver Age. I actually wrote up into 1955 in the original Golden Age book, because, you know, even though it's really kind of hard to think of the early 50s as being still part of the Golden Age, the medium and the storytelling conventions really hadn't changed that much. There wasn't really that much of an opportunity to change them all that much. And if you cut the Golden Age off sometime in like 1950, you're left with this like shrug your shoulders era from like 50 to 56, when you still have important trends going on. So for me, it was neat to do a quick 20-year cutoff of 35 to 55.
You know, it's important for anybody to remember that these terms, Golden Age and Silver Age, and the later names, which I find of increasingly little use, frankly. I mean, I'm just trying to piss on everything, but these terms are invented for comics collectors. You know, that they were a term of value of the book.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And so a Golden Age book did not mean that it was the Golden Age of comics, as in good. It meant Golden Age as in most valuable.
Well, for some of us, it does.
Well, if the best comics out there are the ones from 1942, Chris, that's not true. You love lots of books more than you love.
Dr. Comics, I was just trying to inject a little levity.
Oh, okay. All right. There you go. All right. Okay. I stand down. I apologize.
Got to watch out for PhDs. They don't have a sense of humor.
I'm sorry. It's true.
I actually have a question for you.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. All right. Have you ever heard of the term Platinum Age? I don't want to pull us too off target. I just want to see if this is a real thing or not.
Yeah. We use that. That's actually an academic term. It may have been invented. I don't know where it came from. I could check. I mean, the creation of the terms gold and silver, bronze age, there's a long essay in Overstreet Price Guide that used to outline where those terms were originally coined and invented. And Platinum Age may be discussed there. But in academia, okay, Platinum Age refers to a lot of like late, it goes all the way back to the late 18th century.
Yeah.
It's comics art that was invented, like Rudolf Toffler and people like this, who were drawing what today we would look at and say, oh, that's clearly a comic. But it wasn't as refined as later comics. For example, there were no panel borders.
Yeah.
Like you would draw pictures in sequence and there'd be word balloons sticking out of them, but there was no like clear understanding of page composition or panel layout.
I ask because I had never heard of this thing until I tried to sell some stuff on eBay.
Yeah.
And I was like, is this a thing?
Yeah,
this is a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing. Yeah. And there's books and about it, and scholars have devoted their careers to studying it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's like everything before the comic book arose.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, Golden Age.
Right. Anyway, all I meant to say was that these terms are not very useful, and so that time period that you were talking about between Golden Age and Silver, and the fact that there's a, because to me, the clear end of the Golden Age was always the Comics Code Authority. You know, that to me. But that, as you say, that leaves like time period in between the rise of.
You could also probably date it to the end of the 52-page comic book, when everything got shrunk down to 32 pages,
yeah,
whatever it is.
Yeah. And so
that happens during the war. That seems a little harsh to me.
No. There was they started off with 64-page comic books. During the war, they got cut down to 52, and then later they got cut down even further. And I don't know if that actually happened during the war or afterwards.
Where did you stop the Golden Age when you were writing?
Where do I stop it?
Yeah.
I stop it pretty much, I follow Roy Thomas on it. When the All-Star Comics turned into a Western comic book, I end the Golden Age.
Fair enough.
So it's about 1952.
Yeah.
And I actually used that 1952 period to 59 or whatever it is as a basis for a superhero campaign at one point.
Oh, nice.
Basically, everybody was playing the heroes that stepped in.
Yep. Well, I remember that Marvel had that great What If comic. What if the Avengers had survived in the 50s?
The Invaders.
Right.
3D Man and Venus and Marble Boy, I think, and
yeah. Living Robot. And,
yeah, the robot, yeah.
Gorilla Man.
Yeah, Gorilla Man, that's right.
Who essentially became the agents of Atlas when they revived them.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 3D Man was genius. I remember as a kid reading that book, and he was introduced in an issue of Marvel Premiere.
Yeah.
And those two issues of 3D Man, and all I can say is that, like, to a 9-year-old, 10-year-old kid, like, that book was genius. That book was perfect. I looked at it now, it would be terrible, but at the time it was genius.
Now, slightly off topic, is the rumor true that industry professionals have this long-running thing where if they put a gorilla on the cover, they see a spike in sales?
Chris?
Well, that was
Carmine Infantino's comment.
That's something that Julia Schwartz talked about for many, many, many years. Right. And given how many DC comics over the years, especially when they, you know, in like that netherworld of the early 50s, that they really needed the sales boosts, the number of covers that just inexplicably have gorillas on them, you know, you got to think the numbers back up his claim.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Carmine Infantino, when he was the editor in chief, was putting gorillas on covers whenever he could, because he was a firm advocate for that one.
And who would blame him? I mean, honestly, it's a gorilla on the cover.
Yeah. He drew pretty good gorillas, too.
Are there any gorillas in Against the Axis, Steve?
No, as a matter of fact.
We might have to change that.
Yeah, well, clearly, yeah, we
could always... If we do a supplement sequel, we could always stick one or two in there.
I know that's what they did in Stark City, that, you know, we created Stark City and we didn't have any gorillas in it. And so Dan did a little supplement. That's the first thing they made, was like a gorilla crime boss.
Now, Steve, what kind of research did you do in getting ready for Against the Axis, and what kind of comics did you read to promote the flavor of it?
Anyway, before I got seriously interested in gaming and so forth, I read a lot of World War II stuff of one sort or another, histories and memoirs and DC comic books. I've always had kind of a firm grounding in World War II, and then I've used it as a background for games at least three times before I even started working on Against the Axis. And actually, Against the Axis has got a lot of the stuff I did for those games rearranged and placed into a pleasing mesh of incidents. So, like the whole Nazis and their alliance with Valhalla came from a game I did where Hitler was killed, like in 1936, and there was no World War II, And so you had modern day Nazis.
Ah.
With Arnold Schwarzenegger as the Fuhrer.
That's awesome.
Well, no reason for him to leave Austria. So he became a bodybuilder and an actor and eventually a politician in Germany, or Germany, Austria.
That's insane.
He was a figurehead anyway. I use tropes from just about everywhere.
Does anybody remember Strategy and Tactics magazine?
Oh, yeah.
I actually own them, several of them.
I think it was Strategy and Tactics that had an issue called NATO Nukes and Nazis.
Yeah.
I think I missed that one.
And the idea was is that they knew that there were three topics that always sold better war games than anything else. It had to have NATO in it, it had to have nuclear weapons in it, or it had to have Nazis in it. And so they created an alternate history game with all three.
Uh-huh.
And it was a modern day game against with NATO against an axis that had survived against the German Reich in, I think it was 2000 or sometime in the late 90s. And
probably.
And I ended up using that setting for a role playing game campaign. Players dig punching Nazis. Like it never fails, man.
Yep. So I got to ask, how many people on the panel are big fans of Iron Sky?
Yo,
I watched for about 5 minutes. Couldn't get into it much more than that.
Was it bad?
You've got to take it as an experience. When the Nazi dirigibles come down off the moon to attack Earth, that's just a pinnacle moment. And yes, they're dirigibles.
You know, if that had been the whole movie, I might have appreciated it. But it just keeps getting interrupted for a hey, guess what? Sarah Palin's dumb moments that it's just like really.
Yeah,
they lost me there.
The Sarah Palin stuff is very interesting in those movies. Like, I've
seen the movie once, and I've completely forgotten any reference to Sarah Palin.
They have like a Sarah Palin stand-in. I forget what the character's name is.
Yeah, because really, what could be more cutting edge comedy than pointing out that Sarah Palin's dumb?
Yeah.
For almost a decade now.
You know,
it wasn't memorable as far as I was concerned.
If they do a special edition where they cut all that out and replace it with a guy complaining about airline food, it'll get hipper. It'll be funnier.
Dogs and cats.
I never heard of that either.
They're different. Men and ladies. Let's talk about relationships. Yeah, it's
yeah.
It's hacky. That's what I'm saying. Hey, how about those airlines, huh?
Yeah.
You guys seen Kung Fury with the time traveling Hitler Viking thing?
I have been told that it is an indispensable movie, but I have not yet seen it.
The great thing about it is you can have it on the background while you're doing anything else, like sleeping, and still enjoy it as much as you would otherwise.
There's a recommendation you don't hear often.
it's not bad. It's just kind of like, you know, you can watch by and go, hey, there's a guy riding velociraptors in Viking era with Thor in the back. Okay, and, you know, I think if you pay too much attention to it.
I'm sorry, like, what movie is this?
Kung Fury. It's it's weird. I mean, his partner's a Triceratops, and it's like every bad 80s cop buddy thing got taken, you know, to extremes. And I'll send you a link, Steve. I'm not sure if I can describe it and do it any justice. But there's a scene where he gets sent back in time to fight Hitler by his hacker friend, who finds a way to hack the time stream with his, you know, Commodore 64 keyboard, and He shows up by the time stream, and there's all these Vikings maidens there. And he goes, hi, where am I? They go, you're in the Viking era. He goes, ah, that explains the velociraptors. And that's the kind of movie it is.
Yeah. That explains it.
That pretty much had all our reactions to it. Ah, that explains it.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying it's you can just have it on while you're working or doing anything else. And, you know, I think if you pay too much attention to it, I think it's best in small doses, I guess is what I'm saying. You know, I'll post you a link to the trailer right there. Anyway, I didn't mean to kill the conversation dead like that. So,
yes, right.
Quick, someone else talk about Golden Age comics. Chris, say this.
Let's kill the conversation talking about Against the Axis.
There you go.
When I was reading this book, your book, I thought I saw a lot of stuff that you had been inspired from Ken Height's books.
The Nazi occult?
Yeah. Yeah.
I initially conceived the concept of not only using my, you know, Valhalla, but Vril. And then I saw a review of Ken's book, and I said, oh, well, that's obviously tied directly into what I need. And I reached out and snatched it. Nice book, good book. And we're using a couple of pictures from it as morgue material for the artists who are doing the comic book.
Oh, yeah, great, good.
And it's got a lot of great stuff in it. I wish actually in many ways I had was not quite so set in several of the aspects of Against the Axis, because I could have made even more out of Ken's book. But having already gone the way that I did, I had to leave out all the infighting amongst the Nazi occult groups and so forth by saying that my friendly neighborhood, taken from Jason, thank you, Jason, alien sorcerer had essentially taken over the Nazi occult thing and made it a working operation.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, because that infighting among the Nazis is sort of a classic Nazi bit, right? Like,
right.
Yeah.
So essentially these Nazis have managed to get their act together, mostly because, again, your sorceress alien has managed to move things in that direction.
Yeah, right on.
Can you talk a little bit about a superhero campaign that operates on multiple fronts? Because, I mean, you have the European theater, you have the Pacific theater of World War II, but you also have, you know, superheroes at home. Can you talk about how the Golden Age handles that and how you handled it in Against the Axis?
Mostly for my playtest, for my actual playtesting for this book, we had, I was keeping things most, but I made use of the Vril Underground as a fast way to suddenly get to someplace in Europe or the South Seas, and it would have been a way to get to Japan if I'd ever done an invasion of Japan scenario, but I didn't. Basically what you've got is all of the various Vrilia colonies who have their little mining operations that go throughout the under-earth to pick up radioactives to bring back and turn into Vril. And as it happens, many of these have been connected. So you can hop in one next to the mountains in Illinois and end up in the Black Forest. So this made things rather quick. And then I had a character who I mentioned but don't actually describe, there's no stats or anything for him, called the Magus, who's one of the Vrilia from Cornwall, who knows the network. So he recruits heroes and hauls them off to take care of various problems in Europe and in Asia. That's about the best high speed I've got, except for my previous World War II campaign, which took place 4 or 5 years ago. I was using M&M. It was, as it happened, one of the players built himself a world-class teleporter. So there they went. So did I just kill that conversation?
No, it's all good. Okay. Was the first Golden Age source book the one that came out for Champions back in like third edition or something?
Yeah, and then there was the fourth edition one, which was my first World War II campaign, and I used every character out of that book except for the government superheroes, because that was our heroes, and The alien with the funny T-shirt.
Right, I remember that one. And then, Chris, you did Golden Age from Eminem, of course.
Yes, indeed.
Why did they? Right. Why was your review on?
I used some of that in my Eminem campaign too. Nice
one. Oh, thank you, thank you.
I also used. Oh God, what do they call it? Damn. I'm sorry. Senior moment, I can't remember the name of it.
There was a Golden Age source book for DC Heroes, too, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, there was, and I used stuff out of that, too.
Oh, Ray Winninger, at the top of his game. That was such a fabulous book.
That I have two copies of that. I could reach out right now.
Nice. Ta-da. Yeah, there it is. Yeah. Chris, why did the reviewer dislike the Eminem book?
Well, you know, at least among us in the industry, there's sort of like a shorthand for the most common unreasonable criticism that you're going to get from one of your books, and that is, I bought X expecting it to be Y, and it wasn't Y, so it's the worst book ever written. Right. And there was a guy who literally posted, this is probably not verbatim, but it's close enough. He almost verbatim posted, I'm a big fan of Godlike. I bought the Eminem Golden Age book, and it's not like Godlike. It's terrible.
Right.
I was sort of expecting there would be at least somebody that would come along and give this guy, you know, like a verbal paint brushing. This is before Jack Norris started spending a lot of time at RPGNet. Love you, Jack. But instead of like anybody coming to my poor helpless book's defense, the very next post is, oh, I agree. That book completely ignored Finland's contribution to the war effort. I find that to be appalling.
And was then it this was like, person Finnish?
Not that I could tell. And those names are pretty hard to mistake. So yeah, and so it just and then it rattled on for like three or four more negative comments. And I'm like, well, hey, there's a year of my life that I threw away because I didn't mention Finland.
Yes. So can we talk about Godlike for a minute, since it's obviously like your nemesis?
I like Godlike a great deal. It's just that I have not written anything for it, and I don't know why this guy bought an Eminem book expecting that it would have Godlike material in it.
I have a question about Godlike, and maybe some of you people smarter than me can answer it.
Okay.
Okay.
Or dumber.
No, y'all, I hang out with people smarter than me. This is a well-established fact. All right, so in Godlike, there are no Japanese super people. This is a rule of the setting. There are American super people and German super people, and every nation in the world has super people except for Japan.
Really?
Yes.
Because I have an adventure set in the Pacific. I wonder what you do in it if there are no Japanese supers.
This is all I know is that the author, his father, fought in the Pacific Front, and he made a very conscious decision, apparently based on his interpretation of Japanese psychology during the war, that because of the way superpowers work in Godlike, that they're a manifestation of your subconscious or something, that by the rules of – forgive my dogs fighting in the background. by the rules of the way superpowers work, and because of the way Japanese society was in World War II, those two things would be completely incompatible. And I wanted somebody to explain this to me.
I you know, honestly, I got it. It's on my shelf. I've flipped through it. I haven't read it in that much detail, but I'm gobsmacked. I don't get that at all.
Yeah.
Although, okay.
Again, the people they do both Champions and Eminem supplements, and they have a very nice little universe going.
Yeah.
And
it's a beautiful game book.
They came up with the theory that the
I said it's a beautiful game book. What? I like the book.
What, the Godlike? Yeah.
Yeah.
These other guys did they had the theory that the Black Dragon Society didn't want super people in Japan. So if a super person stuck up their head and said, I will serve the Emperor, they died.
Ah, I see.
And until Hashiman came down from Japanese heaven and and taught them the error of their ways, and then Japan got four or five supers. But I find it interesting, and I found it interesting in your book too, Chris, that generally the Japanese get very short shrift.
Yes,
by the way, there's these five Japanese supers over here. Now, going back to the Germans.
I can't take credit or blame for any of the setting material stuff, because all I did was the history and the genre stuff. All the Freedom City specific stuff is from Steve Kenson. That's probably why it's the best part of the book. But if they got too much, too little, just enough, I had nothing to do with that either way.
That's why I made an absolute point of making sure the Japanese had a robust set of heroes, because I felt it was they'd been short shrifted in just about every World War II book. The Golden Age of Champions had like three people, and so forth. You know, everybody wants to pound the Nazis, and I understand that, and I've got a lot of Nazis in the book too. Uh-huh. But it struck me that there really should be a balance, and there should be a number of shall we say, Japanese supers to balance the axis.
Well, you know, if I'd gotten my way, no Italians. If I'd gotten my way, I would have done a 128 page book just on setting and genre stuff, and then I would have done another 128 page book just detailing the Freedom City world during that era. But right. But I'm not the one who actually writes the checks. So.
Yeah, you would have done a golden age book you would have done a golden age book that was setting neutral.
I would have done a golden age line. I would have just kept putting out golden age stuff until the SWAT team showed up at my house and pulled me away from the machine.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I could probably get behind that too.
Now, how much of the setting aesthetic will we see in a lot of the art? So far, we've seen a lot of we've seen a lot of villain art and a couple of heroes. Will we see that clean cut image in the Americas? The all the diesel technology. Will we get a lot of that in the art?
Whatever Mike's paying for art.
that's the talented.
All I have any control. All I have any say in is what the characters look like. So.
That's Joe Singleton who's doing the art for us for the most part, and a couple images by John Gibbons as well. So I don't know what else.
It had occurred to me actually that Joe Singleton was working on an awful lot of all characters stuff, and that's great, but. Is there going to be any other incidental art?
Hey, here's the production process happening live before your eyes, ladies and gentlemen.
Let's put Mike on the spot, yes.
Okay. Yeah, we probably should have some fight scenes. Probably should have some action scenes. Let's do an email after this and talk with Joe and see what we can figure out.
I think one of the things that people look for a lot in a World War II book can be what does all of the stuff look like, right? Like everything from clothing fashions to tanks and guns and all of that. Fortunately, a lot of that stuff now, thanks to the age of Wikipedia, we can look all that stuff up online. Right. But in previous books, we kind of had to rely on what's that line of books that describe soldiers in different eras?
Osprey.
Yeah.
Or the publishers of Ken Hite's books.
Yeah.
Decided to go into weird stuff.
Yeah, they must have run out of actual historical soldiers. So.
I guess.
You know, funny story about the Golden Age art I've never actually gotten to tell is we wanted to do an artistic homage to the haunted tank.
Yeah.
And you have to be on the right legal side of homage. We didn't want to go so far as to use an actual Stuart tank, because obviously then you're just drawing the haunted tank and you're saying please sue me. So what I did was I suggested using another genuine World War II tank, the M3 Lee, for the sole purpose of it's the most made up looking tank that America actually used during the war. It looks more like a failed steampunk experiment than it does an actual weapon of war. So we sent the artist like all kinds of references to the actual Lee, you know, expecting people would look at it and go, well, that's a great goofy looking made up tank there, and you know, be able to tell people, no, actual weapon.
Did you have the ghost of Robert E. Lee floating over it?
There is a southern looking ghost hovering over the, over it.
All those serial numbers filed off, huh?
It is most definitely not Jeb Stuart. Totally not Jeb Stuart.
Yeah, the haunted tank is one of those things that's really hard to do right, isn't it? They did a special a year or two ago, and it was just kind of a strange flavor. I mean, that's a real specific tone to strike with that one, isn't it?
You know, and I think the most perfect moment of that I've seen recently is not to get off another project, but the Cosmic Book, where there's a ragtag team of space mercenaries and ex-pirates who are now doing good, and one of them is an animal, and we choose not to use a raccoon for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And it's a platypus, if I recall.
Yeah.
Nice. I thought, okay, that's great. It's off the wall and it works. Back to Golden Age.
When we did our cosmic homage, what animal did we use in place of our raccoon, Walt?
Cudamundi.
Yeah.
You know, interesting story. When I was in, I did jungle warfare in the school in Panama back in the early 90s, and you got to take this great animal class, and they pull one of those things out, and it basically looks like a cross between a raccoon and an anteater. With a long prehensile tail, and you're like, wow, look at this thing. And, you know, they tell you it's in the raccoon family, and then they tell you it is the only thing in the jungle that does not want you dead.
Oh, hey, that reminds me. One of our last podcasts, we were doing a cosmic giveaway. We're going to give away a copy of Mutants and Mastermind Cosmic Handbook, and we're going to email that to Anthony Immel, who's one of our beloved listeners who wrote in asking, you know, entering his name in the giveaway. So congratulations, Anthony.
Congratulations. Hope you enjoy the book.
Anyway, back to Golden Age stuff. Yay, punch Nazis.
So what's everybody's either favorite World War II story or favorite Golden Age story as far as comic books go?
Oh, for me, it has to be the Patriotic Crimes story that they did in the original All-Star Comics, which was one of the original Injustice Society stories. But, you know, seeing the JSA take on a full-fledged villain team and losing, you know, to me, it's. I mean, that just must have blown people's minds back in the day. I mean, seeing an actual team of supervillains, and to me, I still get a vicarious thrill over seeing a Golden Age book that has that much scope and has many more of the tropes that we're used to seeing today, and seeing it happen for the first time in that raw, never been done before form, it's really a real, 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 real favorite.
Yeah.
For some reason, I got cut off.
That's right. You're back. We're just talking about our favorite Golden Age stories.
Favorite what?
We're talking about our favorite Golden Age stories.
Oh, Golden Age. Right.
I've been running a lot of champions. I have been GMing a lot of champions, and I liked champions a lot, but I think everybody that plays it understands that it's a very slow-paced game. It takes forever to do a combat in champions. And so I was running a new group, and we were using DC Heroes. And I was taking over the game just for one session. Like, we had a regular GM. He was taking a break. He had a character for one night, and I was just running the game for one night. So I took the second Golden Age of Champions source book. I converted every single character in it to DC Heroes. And the players fought every villain in that book in one night. DC Heroes let you do that. They actually fought all the villains and the heroes that were mind-controlled. So we went through three fights, each fight with an entire villain or hero team, and we could do the whole fight in an hour and then move on to the next one. And it was great, and I just had so much fun. Now, it doesn't make me like champions any less, although I don't know if I've ever played it since, but but it really helped me understand the differences between game systems and their different strengths and weaknesses. And it was fun to use every single character from a book. Sometimes, you know, we buy these books and we never get to use them. And so it was nice to finally say that I
have. Right.
How about you, Steve? What's the favorite Golden Age story or World War II story?
Mine are actually the Injustice Society of America stories from All Star Comics. From, what was it? I think one was number 35 and one was 41. I could be wrong about the 35
one. Is that the one that Chris was just talking about while you were off?
One of them, yeah.
No, it's you know, a bunch of the DC villains of the time get together to take on the Justice Society.
Yeah.
It's just a typical superhero game, villains versus heroes. Battle Royal, with various strange, exotic things happening in it.
No. Forget it. Never mind. Go ahead.
Okay. In my very early days in comics fandom, which was in the early days of comics fandom, I corresponded with Roy Thomas, and he sent me a bunch of the All-Star Comics on loan. And number 41, which was the second Injustice Society, just struck me as being really colorful and really fascinating, and it was great seeing characters work together and apart and so forth. So that was one of the things that actually hooked me on comic books again. I was just at the point where I was going, I'm not going to read comic books anymore. I'll just read science fiction and stuff. And that, among other things, drag me kicking and screaming back in the comic books.
Man, I wish Chuck Rice were here. He would die from jealousy after hearing that story, Steve. He's a huge Roy Thomas fan.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Oh, Chuck Rice, formerly of Vigilance Press, now in Mayfair. He's a huge Roy Thomas fan. He would die of jealousy hearing that story.
We're losing people.
Sorry. Who's left? Is it you? It's you. It's me. Walt, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Yep.
Chris, you still there?
Hey there.
I'm still here. Back.
Yeah, I just got back. My connection died. So I think we're back up, though, and we're continuing to broadcast.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. The Nazis are trying to shut us down.
Steve, in your book, you use a lot of characters that have appeared in the Heroic Publishing comic. Is that right?
Right.
Can you talk about that relationship at all? Like, how did that happen? How did you decide to use those characters, and was it tough to get the rights to them, or did you have to negotiate that at all, or how that happened?
It was screamingly simple. Dennis Maloney, who's the main honcho at Heroic Publishing, is in my Monday Night Gaming group, and I write comic books for him when he's got money to pay me. which has happened more often lately, so I'm writing more comics for him. So since I knew there was a background in Golden Age for the regular characters of the company, I thought it would be fun to toss them in here, so that like the DC heroes and the Marvel heroes, they would have a game that was based around them. So I crammed them in there, and Mike and Dennis got to negotiate vast, humongous legal documents of maybe 4 or 5 pages. We made all the arrangements necessary and took care of all the money situation one way or the other. And I got to write a Golden Age comic book story. Maybe we'll write more, depending on how well the first one does, outside the aspect of the game itself. And we'll see what happens. And now Mike's gone.
Yeah, Mike had to sideline himself. He's he thinks that there might be a vril after his son. He's got to go pick up his son from daycare.
Aww.
Those of you that listen to this podcast know that it ends every time with Mike going off to pick his child up from daycare. That's established.
Or he has to run for his the service of his corporate paymasters.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about the corporate paymasters. Yes.
Yeah, and don't forget the you know, the long established the fact that he's a what is it, Colorado salsa dance champion?
That's new. I have not heard that one.
Yeah. So what can you tell us about some of these different heroes and villains that we have going on? I know at one point you tapped me because I speak Japanese to help with some of the language. Can you talk about like some of the difficulties in dealing with superhero names in different languages?
Yeah, I tried to get everybody named within their native language, as well as an English translation. The German was fairly easy because that's pretty close to English, and Google does a fairly good job. And a couple of the people I play with, including Dennis Maloney, speak some German, so I managed to get that taken care of. The Japanese was much harder, because all of my Japanese friends live up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I haven't seen them for 20 years. I didn't have a ready source of translation, and the Google thing did not give me good words. So fortunately, Walt was on hand, so he did the translations, and that all worked out pretty well. As far, you know, I tried to keep the English names appropriate for the type of character. Hopefully Walt agrees with me that I came up with some good ones.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What I thought was funny was the some of the Google Translate stuff, because I'm sitting there and I'm looking at it, and it wasn't until I sounded them out that I started dying laughing. right. One of them was
they were
like
actually English.
Yes, they were actually English translations pronounced as a Japanese person would, you know. And what's funny is the Japanese language has no L sound, and certain consonant combinations are difficult. So. You know, they end a lot of their speech in a vowel, so certain things won't just stop like English words do. So I think one of them was like Shadow Blade, and when you looked at it on the Google Translate, it was like, wow, this doesn't look quite right. But you said it out loud, and it was Shadow Buredo, and it's like, oh my god,
that's not right. That's genius.
You know, and what's funny is what's that, Steve?
I could have just put, you know, Google approved under each one of the names, but
I think you got to put a royalty attached to each one of those if you do that.
Yeah.
Mike would be able to tell us more. I think he has family members that work with the with Skynet. I mean Google. How about it, Jason? Chris, favorite Golden Age story?
Oh, I've already weighed in on that.
We went.
Oh, wow. So it's down to me, huh?
It is. It's your turn.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Oh, God. You know, and I a lot of those stories I wasn't really big on, just because it was at the time that those comics were easily found. I was moving on to other things. The one I'm really enjoying now, actually, is, of all things, an indie comic. Great thing about a lot of indie comics is people produce them on the web, so you can read every week. You get a new page. Right now, I'm reading The Specialists. These two guys, Sean and Al, they put out this weekly web comic every Monday. They put up a new page, and it's about a group of heroes that come together, obviously, to fight the Axis powers. But it's a fun little read. The art is hysterical. The art is very reminiscent of something like Atomic Robo. So it's fun, it's light, but like in those, with the tone of the art, when something gets like really serious, as in one of the last panels that they just had, they just put up, there's like a dream sequence.
And the ending is particularly horrific. So with that kind of like light watercolor wash type tones, and you get this horrific scene at the end, you're like, oh my God, it's creepy. Neat comic. They also are running a Kickstarter right now. And we're actually going to have them on the show next week. Anybody interested can go to the specialistscomic.com and check it out. Really, really fun read.
How is the Kickstarter for Against the Axis going? Have we hit stretch goals or anything yet?
Nope, not yet. We're kind of like in a we're hitting into that meandering phase of Kickstarter life. So where people know it's out there, some people are holding off, seeing what's going on. We're getting a lot of good emails and feedback from people. The backers are very involved. I get at least two or three emails from them a day.
Nice.
Yeah, which is really, really good. We're coming up on the $1,000 mark. We've had actually a longtime friend of the show and a friend of a lot of people here, Brandon Blackmore, has already volunteered to create a Bulletproof Blues edition right at launch. Uh-huh. So when those things, when the first book comes out, you'll see Bulletproof Blues side by side with it. So, I mean,
it's a stretch goal that isn't a stretch goal. That's awesome.
Right? How cool is that? I mean, he reached out, so we did some promotional graphics for him. Brandon is top-notch. So to see Against the Axis get the Bulletproof Blues treatment is totally great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've got to read some of these books. I need to read yours, Walt, and Brandon's, because I'm falling behind in my consumption of World War II or comic book based games.
Excuse me. Well, after the podcast, I'll get with you more, and I'll send you a copy, so that way we can get some Steve Perrin love on Supers. Yeah. So before we call it a podcast and you know, duck out from Nazis and Nihon enemies, just out of curiosity, why no Italians?
I thought the book was big. That was pretty much it. If we get to the point where we can be doing supplements, I'll be more than happy to come up with some Italians. I did mention them. If you look in the timeline, apparently the Praetorian Guard got slaughtered when they attempted to drive the Allies out of Sicily. And there's an Icons villain who was supposed to be the descendant of a World War II Italian sorcerer, and I mentioned him along the line as being the only survivor of that particular thing. And so, you know, if you ever want to get some Italians in there, you can certainly use that sorcerer with slightly different abilities. But Joe Singleton insisted on putting a lady he called Fascista on the cover. So that's one more that we've got to come up with stats with at some point.
But, nice.
Not write this, but I just felt it was getting too big.
Yeah, already. Sometimes you have to just call a book done, even when there's so much more to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, see, that's what happened. I went and said, okay, we got to have enough Japanese. And then all of a sudden, well, I guess we don't have any room for the Russians and the Italians. And,
yeah.
Oh, well.
Yeah,
and the Finns. You better put some Finns in there.
Those Finnish fans, those guys will kill you on the reviews.
All right. And some... I would get some French people in there, although it might be hard figuring out which side to put them on.
Could not resist it, could you?
Nope. Well, you've got the Vichy heroes and you've got the Free French heroes, you know.
Now I have to wonder, do the Italian sorcerer is he able to cast spells without copious hand movements?
Well, the modern day version.
Sorry, that was much like funnier in my head.
Yeah. Let's see. Can I get to my Golden Age or my Icons?
Yeah, I think it's like Count Malocchio, isn't it? think his name is Count Malocchio.
Yeah. Yes. Which, since he's got Mal in the name, you know he's bad. Let's see. I'm looking through my. You know, I get the PDFs and then I print them out and put them in a binder. So, big savings there. Count Malocchio has the evil eye, which is the source of his powers. So,
same thing for my mom.
Apparently, he inherited it from his ancestor, who didn't know quite how to use it as well.
Yeah, my mom has the evil eye too. She's from Sicily.
But does she have hand gestures?
She can't speak if you come behind her and put her hands by her side.
Yeah.
She can't speak. Totally rendered mute. It's funny as hell. So, gentlemen,
how funny is it to her?
I'm sorry?
How funny is it to her?
Oh, she gets very mad. What are you doing to my hands? You need to stop that. Let me go. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff. So, before we call it a podcast, is there anything else, Golden Age or Against the Axis, that we'd like to, people to take away from this?
Yeah, if people are Eminem fans, one thing they might want to be keeping an eye out for this year is at some point we're going to be doing a PDF release about Emerald City's World War II era and heroes, the Victory Squadron. And as objectively as I can be about it, it's the best thing I've ever written. I don't know if that's that means that it's objectively good, but subjectively, at least the best thing I've ever written. And I'm really, really looking forward to people seeing that. And if you like that, well, there are wartime archenemies, the Ministry of Fear, are also going to be coming out. We're still, that might be Rogue's Gallery. It might be its own thing. But if you want to do some World War II Emerald City games, we're going to hook you up and make that happen by the end of the year.
That's awesome. Nice.
Do we have a release date for that?
Well, it's weird, you know. Thanks to Titan's Grave and everything we got from that, we have actual money at Ronin now. It's like what do you mean we can actually like print books and stuff? So we're trying to sort through a bunch of stuff we wanted to do for a while, like the second edition of Hero High, which is going to knock everybody on their rear ends, the third edition of Freedom City, and some other things, but it's in the docket and there's money to do it now. So no specific date, but it isn't where I'm just sitting here thinking, yeah, before I die, hopefully, which is weird, but good.
Excellent. Jason, stuff, Golden Age or otherwise to talk about?
I certainly am not going to compete with the best thing Chris has ever written.
Whatever that's worth.
I will certainly get it and I'm eager to read that now.
Thank you.
The deluxe edition of the Supervillain Handbook is in layout and it has a ton of World War II useful stuff. Because the whole thing is public domain, a lot of the characters have their origins in the Golden Age. So you will find forgive my dog back there.
It happens to the best of us.
So my dog's
a book full of Golden Age heroes?
Well, no. You know, a lot of these characters are villains. Most of them are villains, and most of them are original. But I did use some from the public domain. So, for example, there's an amazing woman whose origin is based on Amazing Man. We have a modern take on Black Terror. We Stardust, the Super Wizard, is in there. There's a modern take on Green Turtle.
My current project that I'm actually writing these days is the new edition of Superhero 2044, and we're using all the public domain heroes too.
Yeah, not only is there a lot of great material there, but there's also a large fan base. Maybe I shouldn't describe them as large. It's a subculture of superhero fans who happen to be big fans of the Golden Age stuff. And so some of those characters are in our book, and some of them are modern takes of the original characters. But we've also got Nazis and plenty of other stuff like that, too.
Nice snatch away of the toy, Jason.
I'm trying, but I'm not having much luck.
My wife is busy handing out squeak toys to our dogs, so...
But What system is this for, Jason? The icons?
It uses icons, but we're committed to a lot of conversion products. I myself have already written a Savage Worlds conversion for it. None of these books will...
Have you discovered that Savage Worlds is really abominable for superheroes unless you add more stuff there?
Well, it's what I did find. I wouldn't describe it quite that like that, only because we have a lot of Savage Worlds fans. But I will say that Savage Worlds has a lot of it has system limitations that emphasize certain kinds of play, and specifically, it emphasizes low power, kind of dark and gritty play, and it shifts with certain other systems. I mean, for example, in Savage Worlds, an armored vest and a gun, they don't cost you points. They just cost you money. And so there's no reason for any character, and especially in World War II, to not use them. So whatever your powers are, whatever your armor is, or whatever gear, whatever powers you've got, you may as well slap a flak jacket on and carry an M16 or a shotgun, because it didn't cost you anything. So it creates a very unusual vibe, although in many ways best suited to World War II role-playing. And there's a reason why Savage Worlds has a lot of World War II support. It's World Weird Wars setting and a bunch of other stuff. It's very pulpy on purpose. And so certain kinds of superhero play are well-suited to that. So we've got a lot of, like, horror villains and Nazis and mad scientists and dark Avengers that are basically just well-trained people in suits. All of those kinds of characters play very well in Savage Worlds. But characters like Stardust the Super Wizard, who can move Mars by pointing at it, do not work well in Savage Worlds.
Yeah.
All of these conversion books...
And if you want somebody who could look through walls, good luck.
Yeah, right. So these conversion books that we're writing for the Supervillain Handbook are supplements to the main book. They don't replace the main book. They just have the stats for the characters and some talk about how they were converted and how the systems work differently, and some particular advice on building villainous archetypes in that new system. So if you're into Savage Worlds, you'll still need the main book, but then you'll pick up the conversion pack PDF separate.
Yeah. Steve, what can you tell us about Superhero 2044?
It doesn't have a lot in common with the original, because so much of the original essentially became Champions. But you know, the terminology is similar, and you know, I try to keep to the Toolmaster, which we call Tech Wizard, Ubermensch, and Unique nomenclature. We're still using the island whose name has just escaped me. I've been using Iceland as the basis for my playtests, and I've just finished my playtest. I now have, I think, a workable set of rules, and I'm sending them off to my publisher for him to get some blind playtesting done, assuming he does. And his vision is, you don't need to create characters because we have so many that we're going to give you. So in theory, we've got 250 characters.
Wow.
Going into the book, many of which will have unique powers, essentially, written up as part of the character that possibly nobody else can get a hold of. And that's his vision of it, and so that's what we're doing. And I try to keep it as simple a system as I can, although probably there's too much math.
as there always is. So parting shots.
One roll system, but a bit of math when you figure out what the roll is.
Nice. So parting shots about Against the Axis. What's the big takeaway that everybody should leave with tonight?
Dude, it's got magic beer in it. How can you not buy this book?
And walking Panzer tank.
Magic Asgardian beer. It's got Asgardian bad guys and By definition, well, actually, never mind. It's a long story. There are the Greeks really aren't around, although there are people powered by Greek powers. Some of the heroic publishing people are characters are using Greek god powers. You've got aliens, you've got magic, you've got Japanese gods, you've got Norse gods, and an entire underground culture. It's all there.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, I think I'm going to duck out before an Ubermensch finds me and slaps me around a little bit. But I just want to say thank you to everybody again for coming out. Once again, Mike Lafferty had to rescue his heir so that one day there would be somebody to rule over the kingdom. Jason, Chris, Steve, thank you again so much for coming out. And this has been World War II and Golden Age Talk on the Banff Podcast.
All right.